The thing that I'm still struck by is how much positive change can come from simply providing spaces for multiple stories and perspectives. That's how empathy is built.
What I hear over and over again from survivors is that they want to tell their stories.
The Bureau saw the need for a transitional justice assistance mechanism to be created that would, from inception, be survivor-driven and would empower survivors and victims groups to play a more meaningful role in rebuilding their country after a conflict or period of authoritarian rule.
When you get to understand what they have gone through, then you can begin to see them in a different light.
When was the last time you listened, really listened? When was the last time you changed your mind on a subject? What have you done to foster peace and understanding in your community? It may sound simple, it may sound basic, but these are the questions we should all be asking ourselves on a consistent basis.
In conflict, no civilian, no ordinary person goes unscathed. For survivors, this does not change when the conflict ends. Physical and mental reminders of the violence are everywhere, in missing limbs and missing loved ones, in the rubble where hospitals and schools once stood, and perhaps most pervasively in memories. Yaya, a survivor of the Colombian Civil War, will never forget the day she survived a brutal massacre in her small village in the Huayu territory on the Colombian-Venezuelan border. She grabbed hold of her daughters, jumped over bodies, and hid in the bushes. All were saved, but years later, talking about the experience felt impossible.
Conflict silences communities. Trauma, shame, fear of renewed violence are all contributors. In many cases, victims and perpetrators continue to live side by side, so old resentments mix with fresh wounds, but no one really talks about it. Over time, however, the unresolved pain of these events grows and festers, making new violence very likely.
That's Arushni Naidu, Senior Program Director of the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation. That's GIJTR for short. GIJTR's goal is to center the experiences of victims and survivors in post-conflict settings as a way to break these silences and cycles of violence, and in doing so, lay the foundations for peace. Naidu works in the field of transitional justice, often called TJ for short. While the term may seem abstract, it's actually quite tautological. It says what it is. Practitioners of transitional justice seek a specific type of justice for communities attempting to transition from violence to peace. You've likely encountered examples of traditional transitional justice in the news or in history class, like South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or Slobodan Milošević testifying at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
While justice of this sort after conflict is, of course, important, it is often simplistic, focusing almost wholly on high-level perpetrators, on trials and cameras and sentences. In these settings, the experiences and needs of everyday survivors can easily get overlooked.
Everyday survivors like Yaya participated in a series of GIJTR-sponsored truth-telling initiatives in marginalized communities in Colombia. Over 200,000 people lost their lives to the conflict in her country between 1958 and 2013. In 2016, a peace agreement between the government and the country's largest rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, established a truth commission to investigate crimes against civilians. But there were still countless obstacles to reaching and supporting isolated communities like the indigenous Huayu.
Even in the best of circumstances, like Colombia's well-intentioned truth commission, there is no way that such an elevated platform can reflect or capture the experiences of the hundreds of thousands of survivors. And some survivors may not be ready to be in this very public spotlight. While GIJTR does often work in conjunction with these formal transitional justice mechanisms like the Colombian Truth Commission, we have found that creating more safe, informal spaces for victims and families to share their stories is integral to coming to terms with painful pasts, which is necessary if a society is going to break cycles of violence.
For Yaya, that informal space for sharing looked quite familiar. Women in the Huayu territory have a tradition of establishing knitting circles to create textiles for use in their households or to sell. Working with the local women's organization, Fuerza Mujeres Huayu, or the Women's Organization of the Wayuu People, GIJTR sought and found women to join a knitting circle where they could gather and talk amongst themselves about their experiences of the war. While talking, women made a traditional bag, known as the Wayuu Mochila. When they finished their bag, they recorded short messages in their native language explaining, in their own terms, what the violence, killings, and resistance they experienced during the conflict meant to them. The recordings were placed in the bag, which were taken from village to village on a traveling exhibit of sorts, so that other communities could listen to their experiences as well as record new stories of their own.
By knitting these testimony bags, Yaya, who had been so traumatized that she could barely talk about her experiences, gradually became able to share them. Surrounded by a small group of 10 to 20 women, like, her story started to come, and with it came relief. What I hear over and over again from survivors is that they want to tell their stories. For so many of them, that is the first step on the long road to justice. Later, through our program, Yaya was able to meet with the Truth Commission on her first trip to Bogota. In the end, she was able to use her voice on multiple levels to deepen understanding, empathy, and reconciliation within her community, and to foster more peaceful and equitable processes in the country as a whole. This is an ideal outcome, but in post-conflict settings, it is a difficult task.
You're listening to Transforming Transitional Justice, a podcast from the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation, a flagship program of the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, a global network of historic sites, museums, and memory initiatives that support communities to confront painful pasts in order to establish more just and peaceful societies today. Over 6 episodes, you'll hear from local and international practitioners like Areshni, as well as survivors themselves, who are rethinking how traditional transitional justice processes after conflict can better serve the needs of civilians affected by periods of violence or authoritarian regimes. Our goal is to illuminate for practitioners, donors, and general audiences why the experience of these survivors are so integral to future peace, and what tools and strategies work best to engage them. Each episode will focus on common issues that post-conflict communities face, from helping victims heal from conflict-related sexual violence and bolstering communities' ability to search for their missing, to documenting violations. But we'll explore these issues through GIJTR's unique survivor-centered lens. In this episode, we're going to lay the groundwork, establishing exactly what transitional justice is, how previous models have given survivors short shrift, and how new ones can center survivors and create spaces for them to lead. So, Areshni, to begin, can we back up a bit and get a concrete definition of transitional justice as it is commonly understood?
Of course. Transitional justice is a term used to describe the judicial and non-judicial measures put into place by countries in order to address legacies of conflict and human rights abuses. These measures include 4 primary pillars: truth-seeking, which could be truth commissions, formal criminal prosecution, reparations programs, and various kinds of institutional reforms.
And can you say a bit about each of those primary measures? What do they look like? Let's start with truth commissions.
Generally, when people talk about transitional justice processes, they're talking about a truth-telling process, which is essentially a truth commission. The goal of a truth commission is to break the silences during conflict, because as I mentioned earlier, silence and often denial paralyze post-conflict societies. So a truth commission tries to uncover those silences, to deal with the past, to address some of the gaps in the historical narrative, as well as identify ways to make amends for victims particularly. They often result in hearings and reports that present testimonies from victims and recommendations for how to support peace processes moving forward.
And the second pillar you listed?
That would be a prosecutions process, which would look at accountability and ways to hold perpetrators of human rights violations accountable. The third, the reparations process, focuses on recognizing victims and reintegrating them back into society. Reparations can take multiple forms and would include things like financial reparations, but also other things like psychosocial support.
And the fourth?
And finally, institutional reform would look at how we change those institutions, for example, the judicial system, the security sector system that contributed to the violations and continued to cause divisions within a society.
So, to recap, formal transitional justice measures contain four pillars: truth commissions, prosecutions, reparations, and institutional reform. To me, these sound quite survivor-focused. In your view, what are they lacking?
Increasingly, there's been criticism in the field that these formal transitional justice processes don't actually address the root causes of conflict and therefore may not have the long-term impact they need. Because formal transitional justice processes are essentially political processes that come out of a negotiated settlement, some kind of peace process that perhaps is co-sponsored with the United Nations, they are often very limited in their scope and mandate. They focus almost exclusively on civil and political violations during a specific time frame, but not on ones related to long-standing or historic economic, cultural, and social rights that likely contributed to the conflict. In this sense, the traditional transitional justice processes are very removed from survivors and victims, people who have actually experienced the human rights violation.
Can you give some examples of economic, cultural, and social rights? How do these differ from civil and political rights?
Yes. Economic, cultural, and social rights include things like the right to health, work, and housing. Say a community has been repeatedly over decades or even longer displaced from their homes or not given access to adequate water supply. Then one day a dictator comes to power and essentially takes advantage of the situation, increasing his power by escalating the injustice and abuse towards this weakened community through killings and sexual violence. In this hypothetical situation, after the dictator was removed, a traditional transitional justice process might look at the period the dictator was in power, paying no mind to the fact that for decades, if not centuries, the violated community had been stripped of their economic, cultural, and social rights, which also made them increasingly vulnerable. But ignoring these violations, these root causes of the physical and political violence that took place, makes it harder for transitional justice mechanisms to meaningfully reflect the full scope of victims' lived experiences. Where such violations constitute root causes of a conflict, viewing them as merely contextual does not provide recognition, redress, and reparations to victims. This was a common critique, for instance, of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It looked only at the civil and political violations that occurred between 1960 and 1994, but not at those daily social, economic, and cultural violations that allowed the apartheid system to flourish. That's where the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation comes in.
Founded in 2014, the GIJTR seeks to include victims and survivors of conflict in transitional justice practices in a more inclusive, holistic manner. To get a better sense of the needs driving this new approach, we talked to Dr. Patricia Davis from the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, or DRL, at the U.S. Department of State. Given the gaps articulated by DRL policies in the transitional justice space from 2004 to 2023, she oversaw the open, competitive grant-making process through which the GIJTR mechanism was ultimately created and funded. Pat, what need was the Bureau hoping to address through an integrated mechanism like a transitional justice consortium? What, as the Director of Global Programs at the time, was the Bureau grappling with in terms of gaps globally on the ground?
Around the world at any given time, truth commissions or peace processes are being formally set up. But in most cases, survivors were often feeling, or literally were, disconnected from them. These entities were centered in major cities and left rural communities feeling isolated and unheard. Other times, survivors expressed frustration that these formal processes moved too slowly or voiced skepticism that perpetrators would ever actually be held accountable. And those concerns were valid. Even if a new government is set up post-conflict, key actors from the conflict are often still an active part of these new governments. So their political will to fight impunity or issue reparations to victims can be quite low. So it was against this backdrop that the Bureau saw the need for a transitional justice assistance mechanism to be created that would, from inception, be survivor-driven and would empower survivors and victims groups to play a more meaningful role in rebuilding their country after a conflict or period of authoritarian rule.
During DRL's open competitive grant-making process, the anticipated mechanism in the Notice of Funding Opportunity was specific and unique. The mechanism was required to be multidisciplinary, while also having the capability to pursue rapid response and long-term truth, justice, and accountability programming. Could you tell us what goal DRL was striving to achieve in setting forth such specific parameters during the solicitation process?
Yes. Well, first off, it's important to acknowledge that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to helping societies move from a culture of violence to one of peace. That's why DRL articulated in our open calls for proposals that the assistance mechanism must pursue a multidisciplinary approach that was both flexible and inclusive. You have to remember that at that time, neither DRL nor the broader State Department had a vehicle through which to respond to emerging and urgent transitional justice needs. Many of these needs were incredibly technical in nature, such as in the forensic anthropology assistance space, the documentation of war crimes for criminal accountability, and memorialization of the past. You had several excellent individual international NGO groups doing this work, but they were doing so in a more siloed manner. So what DRL was looking to fill was this gap in needing a global, in nature, multidisciplinary structure. As DRL sought to develop a global transitional justice assistance mechanism, we knew, though, that it had to be based on bureau needs and policy, that it was important it be geographically diverse, and that it could build the capacity of civil society, community-based groups, and survivors in a range of ways. The idea behind DRL advancing a transitional justice mechanism was that it would be based on the needs of one country or the particular context, that the mechanism must and could be flexible and adapt to that particular situation on the ground and be locally driven. So throughout the history of this initiative, we have seen how our mechanism has indeed met many of the Bureau's policies, goals, and objectives in the transitional justice space. For example, if a conflict is new or violence is still ongoing, assisting CSOs and survivors to address their emotional needs through sharing their stories or art methodologies can be particularly useful. In other settings, say in a refugee camp, documentation may be the urgent need. For example, the GIJTR has been working since 2019 in the Rohingya refugee camps in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh to train local practitioners in documenting the human rights violations they have experienced. All this in order for this information to be available for any future accountability proceedings. Of course, there is often a mixture of needs are present, which means that the TJ mechanism is equipped to handle because programs are tailor-made to that particular context. This mechanism has been particularly critical to DRL and the broader department's efforts to promote global peace and reconciliation through transitional justice efforts, given the increase in multiple evolving conflicts around the world.
In your previous role as director of DRL's Global Programming Office, you represented one of the United States government's most influential and largest assistance entities, focused on global and national programming. However, in providing funding for GIJTR, the U.S. is supporting a very localized approach to conflict resolution. Is that a contradiction?
I have to say it is not. As citizens of the world, it's our duty to advocate for just and peaceful societies, no matter where conflict is occurring or has occurred. But we're also cognizant that there are different approaches to do this and that there are different lessons learned on how best to produce results. At the same time, we also know that historically, transitional justice measures have been established with little attention paid to local needs, local knowledge, and to the fact that there are differing systems of conflict resolution. This is incredibly short-sighted for several reasons. First, communities know best what they have experienced. Secondly, local ownership and knowledge reveals layers of identity and nuance that may exist in a country or region. layers that resist harmful simplification and that outside international experts may not understand. Third, communities must be present and engaged in the process of rebuilding for those efforts to address their unique needs. So civil society and survivors are more likely to trust someone from their own communities, and that means you're going to get more detailed and more accurate testimonies. Lastly, another reason that post-conflict peace efforts must be embedded in communities is that they're the ones who are there to stay. While the experience of the international experts in broader transitional justice and other contexts is often helpful, those experts will eventually leave. And if survivors, activists, and practitioners on the ground aren't included in rebuilding the country from the beginning, they will lack ownership and buy-in, factors that increase the likelihood of sustainable peace.
To understand how violence and human rights violations affect individuals in the long term, we spoke to Anna Moyo, Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, CSVR for short. The Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation is a GIJTR partner in South Africa, working intimately with survivors and victims to support their psychosocial needs. Understanding the long-term consequences of violence is critical to addressing the post-conflict needs of individuals and communities.
As the center, we do study violence to understand what causes violence, the intersections to violence, but also through the work that we do, we provide mental health and psychosocial support services to victims of gross human rights violations and victims of trauma. And in providing these services, we are facilitating healing, and also we do this work to sort of guarantee non-recurrence and spiraling back into conflict, where we want to see healed communities, healed individuals, healed communities, and healed societies that can build and sustain peace.
We're used to seeing images of victims in the news, but it can be hard to see beyond these depictions of victimization to the thoughts and feelings of individuals in order to really understand the emotional and practical challenges they face. Can you share some insights into what these individuals face as they deal with their experiences?
The challenges that they face are at different levels. So victims of gross human rights violations, or victims of conflict or victims of trauma are people who are traumatized by the experiences that they would have undergone, experiences of brutalization, experiences of harm and suffering that they would have gone through, experiences as well of trauma, where, for instance, they may have experienced torture, they may have experienced other forms of violation. They may have been violated themselves, sometimes sexually, or they may have been denied some of the basic rights, like may have been denied food, access to their families, and so forth. All those are traumatic experiences that victims undergo. So they are really severely traumatized. And this impairs, for instance, their normal functioning in society.
It's important for care providers to know these physical and psychological manifestations of trauma. Can you say more about what the impacts of trauma can look like in everyday life?
Sometimes when you are working or trying to engage someone who's severely traumatized in a workspace, working with them, you may see them as someone who's slow in understanding simple tasks that are assigned to them, someone who cannot follow through, someone who's not performing, for instance, in the workplace. Simple tasks are things that they really struggle to deliver on. They may appear to be antisocial and reclusive, for instance. They may also appear to be flighty. You know, anything that happens, any noise, they react to it. They may appear to be jumpy, for instance. Sometimes they may even be physically unwell, where they present with a number of physical illnesses. They may suffer from recurring headaches or chronic headaches. They may sometimes even suffer from some form of paralysis, which is neurological, but linked to their trauma. To someone who may not understand trauma, you may think that this person is just is a bit too much. They are you know, they are overreacting to things, but it's really linked to their trauma. When you get to understand what they have gone through, then you can begin to see them in a different light. In a relationship, for instance, in a family relationship, say in a husband and wife situation, a person may not be able, for instance, to engage intimately with their partner because of the trauma that they may have undergone. So they may be refusing intimacy. They may not be able, for instance, to even relate well with people in a family setting. They may be short-tempered. They may be easily frustrated and irritated, for instance. They may not be able to hold down a conversation in a good way, in the sense that when something is being said, it can trigger them, and a conversation that is peaceful can easily escalate into a full-blown conflict. But it's now when you understand what they have gone through and how some words or some actions may easily be triggers to their trauma and traumatic experience, that's when you can engage with them differently. And once they have gone through a healing process, all of this become, all of these different manifestations of trauma, the physical, the psychological, the neurological, for instance, they all disappear, because the person now would have regained the normal functioning of all their faculties and senses.
Thank you. And you raise an important point that is often overlooked. Healing can happen. It may seem like recurrent violence is inevitable, but there is hope. When we provide victims and survivors with the mental health and psychosocial support they need in a holistic way after encountering violence, change can happen. So, what does that support look like, and what methods are particularly useful in advancing mental health and psychosocial support, whether it's within formal or non-traditional transitional justice processes?
We do not come with a clearly defined method of addressing trauma and traumatization for specific individuals, families, communities, and societies. We don't have a one-size-fits-all to addressing trauma and facilitating healing at multiple levels, be it at individual, family, community, and societal levels. But we build in the context, the contextual realities, the contextual resources and networks of support that victims may have in their daily lives. So some victims, for instance, may believe in certain rituals that for them speak to or facilitate their healing, and that is okay. Some victims may use religious methodologies towards building their resistance, their resilience, and healing, and that is also okay. And some people really would say, okay, I just want counseling, trauma counseling, and they go through that process, and it's okay.
In addition to individual trauma, we see collective trauma of communities living where violence or gross human rights violations have happened. Can you talk more about its impact at that level?
By virtue of belonging to that community or to that group or that ethnicity, it means that you are also traumatized, because it could have been you. It could have been someone you know. And just that knowledge alone is traumatic. When we are looking at dealing with different levels of trauma and traumatization, we now need to look at that society as a society that needs collective healing, because everyone within that society, everyone within that country has experienced secondary traumatization by virtue of being in that country where gross human rights violations have been happening, where perhaps a conflict has happened, has occurred, or just, you know, by listening to it in the radio, listening to it from seeing it, hearing it from various media platforms, and knowing that perhaps family members in the country, it could have been you, or knowing that it's at this region or province and it hasn't reached my province yet. But by virtue of belonging to that country, there are different rounds of trauma that you undergo, just holding your heart, thinking about how safe am I, thinking about flight, and all the fear that it invokes. It's also traumatic.
So part of this holistic approach is recognizing that trauma occurs on many levels. It happens to individuals, families, communities, and societies. There are also different levels within each person's own experience. For example, at the point of violence and then in the recounting of that violence. How can transitional justice mechanisms adapt to these complex realities?
So if you look, for instance, at your truth-telling processes like your Truth Commission or Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it's important to support that mechanism with mental health and psychosocial support services, because for victims to speak about their own experiences of trauma, of gross human rights violation, the harm that they have suffered, and the suffering that they would have gone through as a result of conflict or gross human rights violations, the retelling of those stories evoke certain emotions associated with trauma, and it could really re-traumatize them. There is also collective trauma, which goes beyond the person who has suffered directly from a traumatic experience. So this is now where we look at the family members as indirect victims of trauma, for instance, because they have heard from the family member what the family member went through. And by virtue of them hearing, they become traumatized. By virtue of them seeing their family member go through all these different emotional, physical, and neurological impacts of trauma, it also means that they are affected in a way. And them being helpless also is some manifestation of trauma.
Truth-telling and reconciliation processes can seem like the opposite of asking communities to move on and leave the past in the past for the sake of peace. But they work only if they intentionally address how to heal from trauma at individual and societal levels. Just bringing what happened to light does not automatically ensure resolution or peace.
We think that truth and reconciliation commissions are going to lead to healing. But so when you tell the truth, don't put and not put specific mechanisms, programs, and initiatives that are aimed at healing, it also means that that truth remains exposed. And this is where, for instance, you get people wanting to take revenge, people wanting to find some form of justice in any form that, you know, this justice may be in any form that this justice may be implemented in their own eyes. And this is how we easily see recurrence of conflicts, for instance, and previous victims becoming perpetrators of today's conflicts, because their violations, their acknowledgement, and their healing was never prioritized in the first place. A country like South Africa is a very good example for this. In South Africa, we went through a Truth and Reconciliation Commission process, went through a truth-telling process. There were reparations that were given, but we did not address the trauma, the individual trauma, the collective trauma at community level, particularly focusing on communities that were sites of atrocity, sites of gross human rights violations. We did not even at all look at societal trauma as a nation that underwent apartheid, how those experiences, for instance, leave an indelible mark in the lives of those who experienced it firsthand, but also how some of that trauma has been transferred to the next generation. So we have a situation in South Africa where the previous generation that actually experienced apartheid directly is sort of numb because of the trauma, but the current generation is angrier than the previous generation, and they don't understand why, because that trauma has been transferred to the current generation, and the current generation are manifesting it through violence. So some of the violent protests that we see in South Africa around issues of inequality and so forth, the kind of violence that we experience with sexual and gender-based violence in South Africa, the normalization of violence, for instance, in communities, in society, all of these are quite telling of what is outstanding, particularly around the collective healing that was needed at a societal level. We are still one of the countries with the highest levels of violence, even though we are not in active conflict. And all of this speaks to the unaddressed legacies of violence and brutalization that were not addressed through collective healing for a society like ours that underwent this kind of brutalization under apartheid.
This brings us back to the task of addressing root causes of conflict. Psychosocial support is a tool for doing just that, addressing legacies of violence and preventing violence from happening again. How can transitional justice mechanisms consider root causes and factor them into the healing process?
When you look at some of the root causes of conflict, for instance, it's really built around lack of trust, lack of healing, lack of societies to deal with the legacies of the past, for instance, particularly legacies of violent and brutal past. On the African continent, we talk a lot about the impacts of colonialism, for instance, on what we see happening in the now in our countries. We speak of the impacts of slavery and slave trade in Africa in the now and how that manifests and informs some of what we see, the violence and the conflicts that we see in the now. And then you come to your apartheid in South Africa, the Red Terror in Ethiopia, genocide in Rwanda, just to mention a few. When communities and societies don't heal from the brutal past, the violent past that they emerged from, and we sort of try and sweep those occurrences and the trauma associated with that under the carpet, and we frog march everyone forward and say, let's let bygones be bygones, let's forget about the past, let's build a future that is more peaceful, without actually addressing the trauma at different levels, the individual, the collective trauma, and the societal trauma, that it's akin to literally bandaging a wound and letting it fester inside the bandage and hoping that healing will happen automatically.
To fill these gaps in addressing survivors' psychosocial needs and also the root cause of conflict, GIJTR incorporates a process called memorialization into every aspect of our programming. To better understand how it works, we asked Areshi United to explain exactly what memorialization is and why it's so useful.
At GIJTR, memorialization is essentially the fifth pillar of transitional justice. It provides safe and protected platforms for communities to remember the past in honest, transparent, and ever-evolving ways. When we think of memorialization, we immediately think monument or memorial, brick and mortar. But those are just one aspect of memorialization. In GIJTR programs, memorialization often includes more organic, less permanent initiatives that are tailor-made to support a community's psychosocial needs and focus on ensuring that historically silenced voices are finally heard. These can include initiatives like traveling exhibits that deepen dialogue on truth and justice in rural communities, oral history collections that record the stories of marginalized groups like women, and arts-based workshops that bring together groups from different sides of a conflict to share their experiences in a way that fosters empathy and understanding. It's a powerful mechanism to rewrite the past in a more truthful way, a way that includes all citizens and legitimizes the experiences of victims of human rights atrocities. There is a growing recognition that memory is an integral aspect of coming to terms with the past and an important part of any transitional justice process that seeks to set the historical record straight. You'll frequently see memorialization framed as a form of symbolic reparations in Truth Commission reports. An example of this could be renaming public facilities or streets that once honored perpetrators. What GIJTR embraces is memorialization's very flexible nature. As I said earlier, transitional justice processes are very limited, firstly in the time that it takes, as well as in the scope, meaning that the groups it reaches out to. But memorialization can happen at any time of the transitional justice process. So it can happen during conflict, it could happen post-conflict, as well as way after the conflict. Also, memorialization often requires minimal resources and has the potential to engage a large group of people from different communities. In addition to that, memorialization, even though it's considered a soft issue in transitional justice, has the potential to raise questions around accountability and around justice.
Is it fair to say that as you see it, memorialization is an expansion of transitional justice processes, not a replacement for formal processes?
I think that's right. But one of GIJTR's goals is to encourage transitional justice practitioners and policymakers to rethink their terms. I think one of the first issues is the fact that local practices, which are often at the heart of memorialization activities, are called non-traditional or informal. The reality is that there could be multiple transitional justice processes at a local level, as well as at a national level, that can actually live side by side each other. And those are all relevant and all contribute to goals of truth, justice, and reconciliation.
To wrap up, we spoke to Brahmi Palugasingham. Brahmi is the Senior Technical Advisor and Lead of Transitional Justice and Accountability Programs at the Department of State's Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. We asked her what has changed in the field of transitional justice with the establishment of TJ mechanisms like the GIJTR.
I think the primary lesson or takeaway from the work is that a long-term multidisciplinary transitional justice mechanism like the GIJTR and other standalone organizations that DRL supports, such as the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala, the Center for Study of Violence and Reconciliation, they work side by side and with survivors and local civil society, which is essential to rebuilding societies torn apart by conflict and legacies of violence. It's not just enough to have a high-profile trial or formally establish a truth commission that only a few can reach. If the experiences of civilians are not fully woven into transitional justice processes in an intentional way, one that explicitly works to heal the individual and collective trauma that has resulted from the conflict or period of authoritarian rule, then the violence is likely to resurface eventually. I'd like to give you an example, taking a look at the subject of forensics. In a traditional transitional justice setting, a truth commission may have established an Office of the Missing and Disappeared, whose mandate was to search for and identify the remains of those killed in a conflict. This is obviously very important, but often families of the disappeared were not included in this process at all. Remains might be identified and family members informed, but often nothing more than that, nothing deeper than that. Little to no attention gets paid to helping survivors heal from the trauma, or if they choose, seek justice for their loved ones. For DRL and supporting forensic assistance that is tied to justice and accountability work, it is important to center those survivors in the process, position them to lead, and train civil society organizations in communities with missing and disappeared families, and to work with families every step of the way. DRL works with organizations that understand that if the remains of a disappeared person are found, for families, it's just not enough to get a routine letter with that information. Instead, they're welcomed into the forensics lab and attend meetings where they can ask questions they may have. They're given time and space to honor and say goodbye to their loved ones with dignity and psychosocial support on hand. And they're invited to join a community of people like themselves who have also lost relatives. Finally, if they want to, they're empowered to learn the skills needed to advocate for justice and work towards a more equitable and humane future. This kind of support is far more effective than past processes when it comes to healing the wounds that, if left unaddressed, can lead to renewed violence. And it's this kind of approach that DRL advances in mechanisms such as the GIJTR and with other grantees that DRL supports across the transitional justice field. Ultimately, the most important takeaway is that survivors are central to peace building, because so often that is where the trauma lives. Without addressing and alleviating that trauma and the root causes of it, violence is likely to reoccur. Holistic, flexible approaches to healing from conflict work better than simplistic one-size-fits-all models. We know that conflict poisons so much, fueling prejudice, misinformation, and silence. And we need more than one strategy.
Do you have any suggestions for national and international actors who are interested in adopting this more holistic, multidisciplinary approach?
Yeah, I think that civil society actors in country, along with international actors, really should start by building coalitions and partnerships, including with a wide variety of stakeholders. This could be inclusive of actors from governments and religious leaders, Really, most importantly, also inclusive of marginalized groups who have been historically silenced and who are so often those most affected by conflict. Only when all survivors have a seat at the table to share their diverse experiences and hopes, and that includes groups that have been traditionally marginalized in many societies, like women, racial, ethnic, and religious minorities, indigenous groups, LGBTQI communities, and disabled persons. Having worked in post-conflict settings for nearly 20 years, the thing that I'm still struck by is how much positive change can come from simply providing spaces for multiple stories and perspectives. That's how empathy is built, and also trust, which are both crucial in any functioning, healthy society, whether in conflict or not. There's a few questions that I have. When was the last time you listened, really listened? When was the last time you changed your mind on a subject? What have you done to foster peace and understanding in your community? It may sound simple, it may sound basic, but these are the questions we should all be asking ourselves on a consistent basis.
Indeed. Thank you, Brami, for leaving us to consider those thoughts as we wrap up this first episode of Transforming Transitional Justice. And thank you to all our contributors on this episode. Stay tuned for episode 2, where we'll explore a holistic, survivor-centered approach to what is an all-too-common feature of conflict, conflict-related sexual violence. Transforming Transitional Justice is a production of the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience and the Global Initiative for Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation. It was produced and edited by Katie Marquette at MediaMart. Views expressed by non-U.S. government employees in this episode do not represent the views, nor should be seen as endorsed by the U.S. government.